What if I told you that this past Friday, June 24th, Supreme Court opinion overturning Roe v. Wade had very little to do with Donald Trump being elected the president of this country, and almost everything to do with a half century's worth of efforts by some of the most powerful people in the country to get that legal precedent overturned? This is No Alter Egos, and I'm Trill Kennedy. Welcome to No Alter Egos. For those who have been listening in for a long time, this episode is going to be a bit of a difference and a change for you. For those who are new, welcome to the show. We're actually on our first week of trying something extremely different from what we've been doing for the past year and a half now almost. There is a change in format that's coming to the show. It's been a few weeks now in the making as I wanted to make sure that it was something that could be handled properly and done properly. And so moving forward, No Alter Egos is going to be split up between two different types of shows on a week-to-week basis. You see, last year I made the change from doing interviews every week to doing just a weekly current events show because I found it to be extraordinarily difficult to be a show booking coordinator, to keep on top of people. I had some guests cancel at the last minute, and then when you're looking forward to doing an interview and that interview doesn't land, you have to scramble to put together a show. And let's say there was a contingency plan, that would require me doing two shows a week, and with the amount of time and effort that goes into just making an episode of this, it just wasn't reasonable to ask myself that, or to ask myself to do that for this. And so I took a step back and said, you know what, I'm just going to go straight to delivering current events with a fresh and clear perspective on it. And as I said just a few moments ago, that even got to a point where it's just like, man, what's going on in the world currently kind of sucks. And I wanted to be in a place where I could still entertain people, but help educate them on what's going on so that we can be more aware of what's going on in the world. And so, as we're making this content shift, the show is going to be split up between interviews that take place from time to time. So, of course, for those of you who have been listening in recent weeks, you listened to the two-part interview with myself and entertainment industry legend Mr. Paul Porter. It was an amazing interview, a wonderful interview. It was a really great time to be able to sit down with him, pick his brain, and I'm sure that we're going to have another interview in the future. But it was a really great way to get things started. But moving forward, if there isn't a weekly interview that's scheduled for that week, I'm going to be bringing you guys breakdowns and synopses of one of my favorite forms of content to consume, which is documentary film. I think one of the most important things that we have in the world of content creation and entertainment is the documentary film format. We often go to movie theaters and we're seeking to be taken out of the world for just a little bit. And so we go to see the big blockbuster, whether it's Top Gun 2 or Thor: Love and Thunder. We have all of these large films that are coming out in cinemas that are meant to suck us away from the reality of everyday life and transport us to these fantastical worlds. But to be honest with you, there's only so much distraction the human mind can really take on at a time. And one of the things I've always loved about documentary filmmaking is that these people that take the time to put together documentaries not only take the time to research their subjects, learn about what it is that they're trying to put out there into the world, but they also go the extraordinary lengths of putting it together in a form that's entertaining, educational, and really sheds some light on a lot of the things that's going on inside of the world. And so moving forward, we're going to be starting a new mini-series here on No Alter Egos called Let's Doc About It. And so from week to week, I'm going to be bringing you guys some of my favorite documentary films, breaking them down, talking about what they are all about, giving a synopsis, and then giving you the place where you can go find and watch it, giving you that recommendation. And my hope is that in connecting you to some of my favorite pieces of content, you'll walk away a little bit more enlightened. If you're listening to this on the radio, you'll have a chance still when you get home to go and look it up, whether it's on Netflix or Hulu or Prime Video, however it is that you stream your content. Even if it's on YouTube, you'll be able to find it. And to those who are watching this on the YouTube channel, I can point you guys in that right direction as well. Obviously, those who are watching and consuming the podcast on YouTube get a chance to see my face and hear my voice. But that was one of the most important things for me, is that I wanted to find a way to be able to still keep you guys informed on things that are going on around the world without being sucked into like the craziness of the everyday news cycle and really a lot of the bloodiness that comes along with that. You know, right now there's the war in Ukraine. There's more mass shootings. There's just a mass shooting in Oslo, Norway. I mean, the world is kind of gone mad, but maybe it's always been a bit of a mad place. And that's one of those things that I love about documentary films is that they show that a lot of these things that we often find surprising are things that have been going on for quite some time, just hidden beneath the surface. And so my aim and goal is to bring some of these films and some of their subject matters above the surface into your hearts and minds and share pieces of content with you that I truly and genuinely enjoy. So this week, I thought it would be the perfect week. And it's ironic because it didn't even happen until this Supreme Court decision came down. But we're going to kick off the Let's Talk About It miniseries with Reversing Roe on Netflix. And it's a sad irony that it's going to be the first in this miniseries that we talk about, but I think it's more poignant and important and necessary than ever to shed light on a documentary film that has really highlighted the heart of the abortion issue, the choice issue, if you will, or the life issue as it's framed in other circles here in our country. So often, we just see it as this political football, and it has been, and I'm going to get into that in a little while, what it has been historically, but I think this documentary on Netflix is so important that I chose it to be the very first documentary that we kick off the Let's Talk About It miniseries here on No Alter Egos. And so, yeah, we're going to jump straight into things. For those who are unfamiliar with Reversing Roe, if you've never heard about it or seen it, it's an incredible documentary that's out on Netflix right now. And it struck me as I watched it just how everything really has come to fruition. That's why I led the show off with that question, because for a lot of people, the fact that we have these new Supreme Court justices and this conservative supermajority on the Supreme Court now that has effectively overturned Roe v. Wade, you know, it's easy to get angry and upset and say, see, you know, this is what happens when Donald Trump got elected. And but the truth of the matter is, Donald Trump is just one in a series of politicians that have been beholden to and answering to another set of people in this country that have been working doggedly since the Supreme Court originally validated Roe v. Wade back in 1973 to get it overturned. In fact, over the course of his life, before he was elected president, Donald Trump claimed very vehemently and adamantly to be pro-choice. The same thing happened, in fact, with George H.W. Bush, the former president, president number, 41, I believe. He was a guy that over the course of his political career embraced the right to choice for women. You know, he had a nickname, and we're going to get into that as well, but he was called Rubbers by some of his close friends because he really believed in family planning, contraceptives, and making sure that if you were going to bring a life into this world, that you had thoroughly thought it through. And even he, by the time he tried to run for election and re-election, shifted over into a strong and firmly pro-life kind of stance and position. And once again, we've seen that pattern play out time and time again. It happened with his son, George W. Bush, as he sought the Republican nomination while he was the governor of Texas. We've seen time and time again now where politicians that maybe have felt one way at a certain point in their life have eventually come onto the pro-life side. And as I was watching, because we had the leak that took place a few weeks ago of the majority draft that kind of set the stage to let everyone know that it looks like they're getting ready to overturn it. And people were up in arms even about that leak of the majority draft opinion. But the truth of the matter is, this has been coming down the pipeline for quite some time. And Reversing Roe on Netflix does an absolutely incredible job, of really going through exactly what led to these moments or what has led to this moment in history. And I'm going to break it down for you at the end of this synopsis because we're really getting ready to do a deep dive into Reversing Roe. But we're going to understand why it is that Roe v. Wade as a legal precedent and standard should have always been bolstered. Why it has been allowed to even be overturned is another issue entirely. But the truth is, we are at this place in space now in history where a lot of really wealthy, really conservative, mostly Caucasian folks who have worked very hard for decades now are finally seeing the efforts that they have put into this massive undertaking really begin to pay off. The seeds that they planted and watered and fertilized and have worked and poured millions and billions of dollars really into is finally beginning to pay off and has officially, as of this past Friday the 24th, paid off with the overturning of Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court as it currently and presently is constructed and as things stand right now inside of our country. So let's get a deep dive into the synopsis of what reversing Roe is about, and let's just walk through the timeline of this documentary. By the end of this, I think you guys are going to want to go and watch it for yourself, but I really want to just provide you guys with a healthy synopsis of what this documentary is about and why we are where we are right now in America. So, like any healthy and educated discussion, we need to have kind of a history and a framework through which we can really view things. What is abortion and what has it been historically inside of America? What has religion meant historically to America? And why do those two issues even, why are they even synonymous with each other? And why do they conflate with each other at this certain point in time? I spoke about a book that I read a little while back. It's called American Demagogue. And it spoke to the fact that demagoguery, people with bully pulpits and people who use the power of speech and being really great at speech to shape and frame the minds of the masses in this country, how it's a phenomenon as American as apple pie. It's been going on since before the colonies gained their independence from Britain. It's been happening after that. And really, it has hit a new turning point here in the 21st century, especially with the spread of social media and the ability for religious institutions to spread their messages out through the culture and to their adherents with lightning speed. And so abortion, let's start there, right? Abortion is something that was codified into law in terms of it not being allowed back in the 19th century here in America. Many states passed laws banning the practice, and we have to understand, and this is where religion comes in, America has always been a pseudo-religious society. If you ask the people that are, whether they are in the halls of power at the state level or even on the right wing of this country has Judeo-Christian foundations in terms of the people who eventually rose to power. Now, the founding fathers themselves may not have adhered to an evangelical type of Christianity. They, of course, believed in nature's God or the God of Providence that oversaw the entire universe. But religion was very much practical to them. And a lot of the founding fathers did practice the religious faith of essentially Christianity, even if they held slightly different beliefs. And while they didn't widely publicize it, it was well known in their private lives that they weren't strict adherents to Christianity as it's known right now and as it's been practiced by some of the more fervent followers of the faith, to put it mildly. So from that foundation and from those leanings and foundations, we have this society that's founded not necessarily on full biblical principles, but with a pseudo-religious principle where God is supposed to be the head of this society because it's from God that all men gain their natural rights. The truth of the matter is, though, from the very foundations of this country, the definition of manhood or men really meant a white gentility, those who were the landed gentry, those who owned property and had money or some kind of status. Those were considered men in America. And from the foundations of this country, they have been the ones to enjoy the full rights of citizenship and just general humanity inside of our country. Extrapolated further, we can see that the slaves, the Negroes, black people were not even considered fully realized human beings. In fact, the Supreme Court in the Dred Scott decision ruled that he needed to be returned to his master because he was not, in fact, a man. He was his master's property. And as such, he could not run away to free himself. He needed to go back to his master and should be returned to his master because he wasn't a man. He was property. So this is also me just framing for you the fact that the Supreme Court does not get every single decision right. We have been misled, I feel, in this country to think of them as this august body that has made and has stood as this line between partisanship in our country, that they can legislate what is right from a high, high, high moral platform, that what they say goes. But the reality is the Supreme Court has always been partisan. It has always had leanings, and those leanings have been mostly conservative. Liberal leanings on the Supreme Court really are not necessarily an invention, but they were new to the zeitgeist in the 20th century moving forward. Of course, you had the first Black Supreme Court justice in Thurgood Marshall, who came on in the 50s. But then since then, we can know and understand that the Supreme Court still fundamentally and foundationally has been a conservative-leaning body. And so anti-abortion laws had been passed all around the territories and states of this country, dating all the way back to the 19th century, the 1800s, long-standing laws banning the practice. And for many women inside of America, getting an abortion or having access to an abortion was an act of criminality. Because it was outlawed, they were literally committing criminal acts anytime they went to seek an abortive medical procedure. Now, this is where the documentary itself kicks off. It starts off with an impassioned plea from a Texas House of Representatives, I believe the Texas Senate. She's speaking and making an impassioned plea against this bill, SB 8, that they're getting ready to pass in the Texas Senate. And as she makes this impassioned plea, she speaks to the beauty and resilience of life and how for many women, experiencing pregnancy is this incredible thing. In fact, the way that you hear her first speak, you may think that she is someone who is advocating against choice and who is pro-life. But the reality is, and even pro-life, that's such an incredible bit of word magic and framing that they were able to do. But the reality is, she then goes on to say that even though she has experienced pregnancy, she has her kids and now her grandkids, it is not something that she believes is fundamentally the job of the legislature to determine. That at the end of the day, there are many reasons why women go to seek out the reproductive health care that they need, even if it's with a procedure like abortion, and that it should not be outlawed for the sake of some moral battle when there are women who really suffer from extreme complications and other issues like that, that they may need to have access to an abortion, and that such a sweeping bill, SB 8, which would essentially shut down about half of the abortion providers in the state by providing almost unreasonably strict standards on them, why it shouldn't be passed. And so she gives this impassioned plea on it. And then after all of that, they still vote. And this is with her being one of the few women inside of the room, 92-42, to pass the bill. It passes with flying colors and gets made into Texas law. And so that's where this documentary kicks off. And so even with all that going on, the bill gets passed. The camera then goes to this young gentleman who's walking into an office, John Siego or Siago. He works for Right to Life Texas. And he goes on to explain the pro-life philosophy. And I'll get to my, I guess, personal feelings on it as I provide my full synopsis at the very end of this. But he essentially explains that the goal and effort is to have bills that they know may be challenged in the courts, that they can eventually get up to the Supreme Court. And what they're looking to do is continually knife away at and hamstring and undercut the underpinnings of Roe v. Wade until it's eventually overturned by the Supreme Court. One of their main tactics to do it is by passing the most draconian measures that they can while they have power in the state legislatures. They want to try and pass these really draconian measures that are harsher and harsher because they know that it's going to invite challenges that may eventually make it to the nation's highest court. And their hope is to eventually get it to the nation's highest court, have enough people stacked on the Supreme Court that they can overturn Roe v. Wade. And I thought that was a really brilliant insight into what the overall strategy is, because it's not just throwing everything at the wall and seeing one sticks. But it also, in a very literal sense, is kind of that outside of the feces. I'm saying, like, in the metaphorical sense, I should say, they were throwing all these things at the wall and hoping that one of them would eventually be well written enough that it could stand up to even the scrutiny of the Supreme Court and eventually lead to a place where they could set almost like a copycat model, where if one bill gets through the Supreme Court, then other bills can be passed by other states. In fact, there are almost 24 states that have trigger laws that went into place and that are going to go into effect now that Roe v. Wade has been overturned. But moving on, just some quick statistics that were also provided. Since 2010, and 2010 was such an important election year, the people that got elected at the state as well as the national level, especially at the state levels, they really began to gerrymander brutally. I mean, they just went with a surgical knife around those congressional districts and really reshaped the districts and demographic map of our nation. And that's important even with the 2020 election to see how there was still so much sweeping power held in these state elections. It's because the 2010 election allowed for gerrymandering at such a strangely strict and partisan level that the seats that had been won, they essentially made themselves kings on the state level, right? But since 2010, over 300 different, and this is something that the documentary points out, over 300 different anti-abortion laws have been passed nationwide, 300 of them. And of those 300, they're obviously of varying strictness, but we were getting to a point where certain states, I believe there were seven states that they mentioned, Missouri, Kentucky, West Virginia, Wyoming, North and South Dakota, and I believe maybe Oklahoma. Oh, Mississippi, that only had one abortion provider left in terms of access to Planned Parenthood, and not even the organization, but just women's healthcare and reproductive centers that provided that service. There were seven states, seven of them, whose abortion bans and restrictions in the laws that had been passed were so harsh that there was only one provider left in each of those states. And so we meet one of the first main characters, if you will, inside of this documentary, which is Dr. Colleen McNicholas. She's the lead caregiver and abortion provider at sites in four different states. I don't want to give them just to protect her privacy, but she is based in Missouri. I can at least say that. And she provides these abortions not because she has some kind of animus against human fetuses, but because both as a woman and as someone who wanted to practice gynecology, she wanted to provide the best healthcare that she could for any patient that she ever comes across as part of the Hippocratic Oath. And more importantly, as these states began to pass harsher and harsher laws, she states how her job is just increasingly more and more difficult to do, right? And so we begin to go back to a brief history of how abortion even came to the forefront of American political thought. But before that takes place, there's this moment of clarity that really sets the stage for the rest of the documentary. There is a security officer, because at a lot of these clinics, they need security, whether it's police or private security, because of a wave of violence that had taken place between the 80s and the 90s, even in the 2000s, where there was violence against the clinics, against its staff, the murder of nurses and doctors. It just got really, really, really bad. But this security officer for this clinic, he, you know, there's some guy that talks about the fact that he's a big time Trump supporter and that it's going to be the end of Roe v. Wade and that they're going to put an end to all abortions in this country. And the security officer says something so poignant. He says, when people ask me my opinion on the abortion issue, I tell them that exact answer that, you know what, it's my opinion. And at the end of the day, my opinion should not control and decide how another person is living their life, short of them infringing upon the rights of someone else. And so he goes on to point out that it's a bit of hypocrisy that he sees when people are trying to force their religious views and ways of life onto everyone else in a country that supposedly is supposed to be about religious freedom. I thought it was so poignant and prescient that he would say that, because for me, that is one of the hearts of this issue, right? The fact that we have certain people in this country who have authoritarian leanings and who feel as though their compass and code and worldview should be the only worldview. I've had arguments with family and loved ones about this coming from a Christian background and pointing out to them even that, okay, so what if enough Satanists get into power and hold elected office? And instead of mandating that the Ten Commandments be in school, they mandate that all schools should have a statue of the Baphomet or of the devil, and that students should have to stand and recite some kind of pledge. You wouldn't like that. And it takes something like that for them to kind of solidify, oh man, maybe religion and government should really be separate, because at the end of the day, if we are about religious freedom, then we cannot and should not impose our worldview on others, short of certain universal maxims like rape, murder, things of that nature, you know? But at any rate, It then goes into the story of Sherry Finkbein. Now, if you don't know who Sherry Finkbein is, she was a television show host based out of Wichita, Kansas, back in the late 50s, early 60s. And in 1962, she had become pregnant with her fifth child. Now, it wasn't that she didn't want the pregnancy. She loved all four of her children that had come before. Her and her husband had been looking forward to loving on this fifth child, but she had taken a drug, thalidomide, that through the course of several studies had been shown to cause severe, severe birth defects. I'm talking babies born with no limbs or eyes, and even stillborns and stillbirths, or just really babies who were born with a very low viability and possibility of survival. So she spoke with her physician about this and said, you know, I've taken this drug. And she was a few months along at that point. And she said, you know, doc, I don't know that I want to follow through. What do you think? And the doctor recommended a therapeutic abortion for her. So if you don't know what a therapeutic abortion is, it's what was the abortion standard back then, because there was no legal federal standard for it across the country. In states that did allow abortion to a degree, what a woman could do, and it was usually a wealthy white woman, is go and sit in front of a panel or board of all male, all white doctors and say, you know, I'm going to kill myself if I have this baby, or this baby represents a threat to my health, my sanity, whatever the case may be. And so in those cases, those doctors would then sit and decide on the fate of the woman and her yet-to-be-born child, the fetus that was growing inside of her womb. And so usually wealthier women were able to access safe therapeutic abortions. But the darker side to this is that for poorer women, especially poorer women of color, but for poor women all across the spectrum, some of them, in fact, a lot of them, were forcibly sterilized. They were harassed, essentially, saying, you know, we don't want to clean up your mess, so in order for you to get this abortion, we have to also sterilize you so that you can't have any more children. And it was this really dark and disgusting practice, but it was one of the few options that women had available to them. I believe at the time they were saying that even though it wasn't allowed federally legally, over 1 million women a year were gaining access to an abortion somehow, and that somehow is usually illegally, and in certain cases, it was self-service or self-performed abortion. And of those 1 million plus, around 350,000 would experience complications during one of these illegal abortive procedures. And of those 350,000, about 5,000 women or so per year were dying during abortions. A lot of them during self-performed abortions where they didn't have proper medical training or someone there to assist them. And it paints this really dark picture about what women in the 50s and 60s had to go through. And so Sherry Finkbein wants to get this therapeutic abortion done. And it just so happens that her going to go get this done, it gets written about in the paper because she's a television personality. And because it becomes public knowledge, the doctors say, no, we're not going to do it anymore. Right? So she loses her ability to get this simple medical procedure done, which it's not as though she was doing it out of coldness and callousness, but because there was the very real possibility that due to the interaction between this drug that she had taken and the developing fetus inside of her womb, she would either have a child that died in the womb or came out with such severe deformities as to be physically almost unable to live a full and healthy life, if any kind of life at all, a child that would die within a few days, weeks, or months after its birth due to the severe defects that this drug was causing. Instead of being able to get this procedure done, because it becomes publicized in the newspaper, her and her husband have to fly to Sweden to go get the procedure performed. And this was a bit of a turning point for her. They made it a bit of a spectacle. She ended up being written about in Life magazine, which is one of the biggest publications in America and in the world at that time, because it highlighted kind of the brutality that a lot of these women were facing whenever they sought out reproductive health measures that went against what society deemed acceptable, right? She really made a lot of noise about it, and I'm so grateful for her husband also for standing by her side and letting it be known to the world that, you know, we're making this decision for us. We're not saying anyone else should do it or should be forced to do it, but this was the best decision for us. And for them, thankfully, they had the means to fly overseas to go get the procedure done. But the truth and reality is that for so many women at the time, that just was not available. And so Sherry Finkbein kind of becomes this face for what is abortion or anti-abortion law really like in this country? And why is it that so many women have to suffer needlessly from a procedure that should be a part of reproductive health care? And so as the documentary moves forward and as we learn about the story of Sherry Finkbein, then comes in Tom Davis, who's actually one of the first clergymen to perform what became, because there was no precedent for it, but what eventually would become known as abortion counseling services. He started off going and providing these services to young ladies at the school where he was the chaplain. And he admitted that he had no idea what he'd be facing when he went into it. You know, he told his wife, you know, there's 1,400 girls that go here. You know, what's the worst that could happen? It's not like there's tens of thousands or a big number to deal with. You know, we'll see what gets there. And his wife said, okay, you'll learn. And he goes to the school, and as he begins to counsel these young women, he explicitly lays out the fact that, you know, I never asked them why they wanted to get the services performed, because he didn't feel it was his business to ask them that. But he goes on to say that they were so open in sharing the varying and myriad reasons why so many young women were seeking to get abortions performed. It wasn't just out of an evil callousness, but there was everything from medical complications to life complications to cases of rape and things like that, where women who maybe didn't feel as though they could go to the police were saying, hey, this happened, I'm now pregnant, and I just want to move away from this traumatic incident. There's all these things that were taking place that he then became privy to as this counselor. He says it's an experience that opened up his eyes as to what was really going on. And, you know, ironically enough, when we think about Republicans today, we think about the religious right, as it were. But it wasn't always the case. There was a shift that took place, and we're going to delve into why that shift took place coming up in just a second. For more No Alter Egos content, or even to speak with me, Trill Kennedy, find me on Instagram at Trill Kennedy or on TikTok at Trill_Kennedy. And you can find the show's handle on both Instagram and Facebook at No Alter Egos. You can also find, follow, and subscribe to our YouTube channel, the No Alter Egos podcast. So the ideological shift of the Republican Party is something that happened very slowly and then very rapidly all at once. There's a reason why even now conservatives love to tout how they were the party that freed the slaves. But the Republican Party of Lincoln very much resembles the Democratic Party. No, I can't say that, because the Democratic Party of today, I don't even know what to call that. However, they were ideologically relatively liberal, but they also believed in personal freedoms. And so they tout this because it wasn't always the case where you had hardcore conservatism inside of the Republican Party. There were once liberal Republicans as well as conservative Republicans, the same as there are liberal Democrats and increasingly smaller conservative Democrats. But we talk about the Southern strategy of Nixon and how in order to win votes across the Bible Belt and in the South, Nixon worked to bring evangelicals and segregationists and all this together to win those Southern states. It was a part of his strategy to win the presidency after his first failed attempt against former President John F. Kennedy. And the Dixiecrats, as they were known in the South, shifted over to the Republican Party because of certain back-channel handshake agreements and things like that made by candidate Nixon as he was seeking the highest office in the land. He essentially was saying there were certain things that they wanted to do, like the segregation of their schools, which we kind of know today as school choice for many private schools and Christian institutions, but we won't get into that. That's another discussion for another podcast. The reality is there were a lot of back-channel meetings with evangelical and Christian leaders, as well as I said, you know, strong segregationists across the U.S. South, where you began to see conservatism take over the Republican Party really, really to a large degree. And then it was essentially culminated with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980 as the president. Now, Ronald Reagan is a bit of an important figure in this as well, because Ronald Reagan actually passed one of the first and most liberal abortion acts in the country, the California Abortion Act. He passed it into law when he was the governor, or the California Therapeutic Abortion Act. He passed it into law when he was the governor of California And it gave women in his state access to safe and healthy abortions during the first two trimesters. That was followed up by New York's Abortion Act passed around 1970, where they said for the first 27 weeks, a woman can have an abortion. And then for anything after that, in cases where the pregnancy could end the life of the mother, she should still have access to those services. And we're going to take a look at how that was twisted in just a little while to fit the narrative of pro-life conservatives in this country. At any rate, Ronald Reagan started out as someone who believed in choice. And I'm framing this because, as I pointed out at the very beginning of this podcast, we have a President Trump who, for most of his entire adult life and life generally, he was someone that expressed pro-choice views. We talked about George H.W. Bush and how he was someone who, through the majority of his adult life, expressed pro-choice views. Ronald Reagan was kind of the same way in that he felt a woman had the right to choose what goes on with her body. However, there was a shift that began to take place, especially with the passage of Roe v. Wade. But before Roe v. Wade gets passed, we have to discuss how this religious fervor and this moral fervor against it even came into being. And this is one of those things I love about what the documentary does, is it provides the historical context in such a complete and amazing way so that we're not just left in the lurch and left wondering how things came to be. We actually have a really clear understanding of the steps that took place. So, as I stated, the California Therapeutic Abortion Act gets passed by Reagan. In New York, Governor Nelson Rockefeller works with the New York legislature, and they get a bill passed that essentially legalizes all types of abortion, especially through the first two trimesters inside of his state. And on July 1st of 1970, the first legal abortion clinic was actually opened up by members of the clergy in New York. They performed around 100 abortions a day for the first 13 months that they were open, and that number only began to dwindle when other abortion providers began springing up so that women wouldn't have to all crowd into this one place. But with that came backlash, especially from the Catholic Church. And I find it very darkly ironic that the Catholic Church tries to take a moral stand on anything. This is, of course, a church where sexual abuse scandal of young children. There's a part of me that wonders if maybe in some kind of sick way, priests just wanted to have more kids to have access to them, which is why they were fighting so hard to get anti-abortion measures and have been fighting so hard historically to get them passed. But that's just me looking at the culture of an institution that's been around for the past 1900 to 2000 years. I digress. The documentary goes on to show Cardinal Terence Cooke. He's a cardinal based out of New York that began to really raise abortion up as a moral issue, stating that, you know, he brings up scripture where God says, I give you life and death, choose life. And he begins to frame, and he becomes one of the main messengers of abortion being a moral issue instead of a women's rights and equality issue. He starts to put the spin out there into the public consciousness, especially in the Catholic Church, which has 2 billion adherents, I believe, on planet Earth now. And back then, obviously, they still had a ton of people in New York. Catholicism was a huge, huge religion. And so he begins to put out there this messaging that abortion has nothing to do with rights and is completely a moral issue regarding the taking of a life, even if it is unborn. And what I find most ironic about all this is that there is no standard and consensus on when a life begins. You have some people that believe that life begins at contraception, which in my mind is asinine and makes no sense, because what is a human being? You have to define what a human being is, and a human being is not a mass of cells that begin the process of meiosis after someone has had an egg get fertilized by a sperm cell. That is nonsense to me. Does it begin when the heartbeat begins? Well, can you really classify that as life if that person that you are deeming as a person doesn't have their brain forming yet? There's all these ways that people try and classify life, but the reality that I'm pointing to is that there is no one standard definition of life, because in my eyes and opinion, until that baby is out of the womb, has taken its first breaths of oxygen, it's not alive in a traditional sense. Stillbirths happen all the time. Late-term abortions happen not all the time, but they happen because there are times when late in a pregnancy, it's realized that a baby is no longer going to be a viable human being. They don't have limbs or they have some severe genetic deformities and things like that, that would make their life essentially a living hell here on this planet. And so we try and classify life in the womb as life, but the truth is, until a baby has healthily either passed through its mother's birth canal or has been removed via cesarean section, and this is just my philosophical standpoint, you cannot classify it as a life, because the only thing that we know that can define life is a person that can consciously experience the world, create and form memories, have experiences. And until you pass through and out of your mother's womb, regardless of the beating heart, the little brain that's in there, you are not technically alive. But at any rate, he goes on to frame it as a moral issue. This is Cardinal Cook up in New York. And so Catholics begin to get up in arms with the passage of this New York abortion bill, so much so that Republicans, even though traditionally and historically have been, or were up to that point at least, a party of choice, they flip because they don't want to get voted out of office. And so they pull up this anti-abortion measure, essentially banning abortion in New York State. And Governor Nelson Rockefeller vetoes the attempted ban on abortion. But what it does signal is what's to come in the fight for this country. So we arrive at Roe v. Wade, the central theme or the central act behind this entire documentary, and what was essentially overturned this past Friday, June 24th. There was a young woman in Dallas, Texas, who wanted to have an abortion. It wasn't specific reasons given. She just did not want to continue her pregnancy past that point. And in an attempt to protect her identity, you know, like we have John Doe, she was given the name Jane Roe in her case. Jane Roe was this woman, as I said, who wanted to get the abortion done. And Henry Wade was the DA for Dallas in Texas at the time. And so abortions were illegal in Texas. And she sued. She sued essentially saying that this is my body. You have no right to legislate the choices that I make with my body. It eventually made it up to the Supreme Court. And ideologically, even back then, the Supreme Court was very much conservative. But the way that conservatives wielded their power, which is why it's so crazy to see it today, was far, far different. At any rate, Thurgood Marshall had been on the court at that time, and the court voted 7-2 of the 9 justices. So 7 of them, even though it was a conservative court, they voted that, yes, Jane Roe has the right to have access to an abortion. And no one in the country can deny women access to abortions with the exception of third trimester or late term abortions. And even then, there were exceptions made for the health and life of the mother, or if there was already a natural abortion, just removing the fetus. There were protections that were put into play with the passage of Roe v. Wade. And that begins this extreme unraveling of the issue across the country. We began to see organizations like Operation Rescue, headed up by Troy Newman, and with spokespeople like Randall Terry, pop up across the country. They were very militaristic in their tactics. And what we were really seeing, unbeknownst to many people at the time, was the political strategy of Republican strategists seeking power really coming into fruition. So there was this marriage between the Catholic Church, the evangelical right, and just hardcore right-wing, in my opinion, nut jobs in this country, led by, to be honest and fair, brilliant Republican strategists who were looking for a way to maintain political power. And so there is actually this hidden history that the documentary points out about the fact that there were schools that represented themselves as Christian schools, including Bob Jones College, led by Reverend or Pastor Bob Jones Sr. But really what they were segregationist institutions. In fact, these were religious organizations and institutions that were claiming that the Bible approved of and encouraged segregation. And so they wanted to find a way to gain tax-exempt status. It's crazy to think about where this entire marriage hinges on, but where the real power play came into things was the fact that these organizations, based and rooted in racism and bigotry, wanted to find a way to gain tax-exempt status. And so they approached Republican strategists like Paul Weyrich and said, hey, we want to find a way to gain tax-exempt status. We need these politicians in office who are going to grant that to us. Now, Paul Weyrich, being a pragmatic man, realized that I maybe can't sell full-on bigotry and racism and segregationists to the American public. But as he began to see the abortion issue coming up more and more with these organizations that had been funded by the Catholic Church and by other evangelical organizations that were essentially speaking out and framing it as a moral issue, he saw the domino that would maybe eventually lead to the tipping over of Roe v. Wade, granting his client access to the halls of power, while at the same time giving people, especially on the evangelical right, an issue that they could unite around that wasn't rooted purely in racism, something that they could claim was a moral issue, the life of a baby, an unrealized life, if you will, that they were trying to frame this argument and issue around. And so Paul Weyrich was one of those fundamental keystones as a Republican strategist that latched onto the abortion issue as a moral and now a socio-political and cultural issue that Republicans could get behind to gain the support of the political right, at least from a Christian or evangelical standpoint inside of this country. And we begin to see over years, as he's working and working and working, where politicians have to begin to say more pro-life things in order to gain political support from Republicans and from the right wing of this country. It culminates with President Ronald Reagan being elected in 1980, a gentleman who, as I stated earlier, had placed so many or had made so many pro-choice statements up to that point in his political career, where he eventually turned around and on camera said, you know, when you interrupt the pregnancy, I think that you are taking away a life. I think it's a morally wrong thing to do. And we saw the same thing with his vice president, the eventual president or the next president of the United States, George H.W. Bush, who would go on to say the same thing. His son, George W. Bush, would go on to say the same thing. Donald Trump, same pattern playing out, where you have guys who understand that maybe choice is important, but who are so beholden and in search of personal power for themselves that they say whatever they can to gain the traction and support of the right in this country. And so the documentary really, in my opinion, did an excellent job of bringing this full history together, where, as I stated earlier in this podcast, that we have a tendency to think that it's because President Trump was elected president that somehow now the Supreme Court has overturned things. But the truth of the matter is, since Roe v. Wade was passed, you had organizations that came together inside of this country. You had organizations that were engaged in acts of violence. The truth is, they realized that they needed to flip the Supreme Court. And that's always been the game. So what does Reagan do? He appoints Sandra Day O'Connor in 1981. She becomes the first woman to serve on the Supreme Court. And at her Senate confirmation hearings, she says, no, I don't believe that women should have access to abortion. I believe it's morally wrong. And so she gets put on the Supreme Court with the hope that she'll be a woman that goes against the rights that women gained in 1973, just 8 years prior, with the passage or with the opinion of the Supreme Court that Roe had a right to an abortion in the state of Texas. It's one of those things where constantly there are people that are put in positions of power to go against their best interests to serve the greater interests of richer and usually wealthy white people, white men in this country, that seek to run this country in a certain way. And so the game and end goal has always been to flip and stack the Supreme Court. We think about Clarence Thomas, who was nominated by President Bush the First, H.W. Clarence Thomas, who's been a man who has been just salivating and waiting for the opportunity when ideologically he was on a stacked and packed court to exact revenge against those people who attempted to derail his nomination back when there was the whole sexual assault in his office scandal that nearly did derail his nomination to the Supreme Court of the United States of America. But the goal has always been to stack and pack the court with ideologically conservative justices. And we've had organizations and think tanks, especially based in Washington, D.C., that have worked to ideologically drill this into the scions of wealthy, powerful families. You're talking about Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh, two of the newest justices and Supreme Court appointees of President Donald Trump, who ideologically came from the same think tank. This is what we have been up against for a while now. And what reversing Roe really did was an excellent job of highlighting exactly how the game of stacking the Supreme Court has been going on for 50 years now, how there have been intimidation tactics, even tactics of violence that have been used over the past 50 years or so, because it's been 49 years, it'll be 50 years or would have been 50 years since Roe was declared able to get access to an abortion. It would have been next year, but clearly that's no longer going to be the case. At any rate, I don't want to spoil the entire documentary for you, and that's the point of the series, is to really give you a good synopsis of the documentary without spoiling the whole thing. There's so much more information that it presents, but I'm going to give my short wrap-up and conclusion of it, and then we're going to have our final thought for this week coming up here on No Alter Egos. Let's doc about it. So what's my overall takeaway from Reversing Roe? It's that we have no clue, and we are just beginning to understand the amounts of money and the kind of seedy and powerful people who believe in social engineering that are really behind the scenes running this country. We really don't have a clue about it. We tend to think of, like, the Illuminati is one of the ones they always like to point out, or whatever the case may be. There's these secret cabals of globalists, but no, the reality is, like, hyper-Christian nationalists, just like in the Middle East, hyper-Islamic nationalists are the kind of people that are working to run this world off of a cliff, because they really do believe in imposing their worldview on the entirety of the society that they inhabit. And we have the same thing going on over here in the U.S. It's just that the extremists that we would think are people in suit and ties who really believe in only one way of life that benefits and empowers them the most, while not benefiting and disempowering as many others and people that they deem undesirable as possible. But what Roe v. Wade really showed is that the fight for rights and equality, not just for women, but for all, is going to be one that's constant and ongoing. Because whenever there is progress made, you can better believe there are people who will work doggedly and determinedly to undo and reverse that progress, because they don't see it as progress. And so they'll use whatever means possible to make sure that their worldview is reimposed, if you will. They'll frame it. I didn't even get into the fact that what we now call partial birth abortions is a lie, a misnomer invented for political talking points in the 90s by Republican strategists. What they were referring to as late-term abortions, and which it represents right around 1% of all abortions that take place, and literally the vast majority, if not the totality of those abortions, are in cases where the pregnancy is threatening the health and the life of the mother. But once again, Reversing Roe does, I believe, an excellent job of framing the abortion debate. Now, some will claim it has leftward leanings, but the truth is they give equal, if not greater, talking time to people on the right side of the aisle who are explaining their worldview, which in my opinion comes from a very totalitarian place. But I once again want to leave that up to you, the viewer, when you go watch this documentary to decide. Let me know what you think in the comments section of the YouTube video if you're watching this on YouTube. If you're listening on the radio, the YouTube video is going to be up Tuesday at 5 p.m. So go check it out. Drop a comment. Let me know not what you think, maybe necessarily about the abortion debate, but if you do have feelings about that, feel free to drop them as well. But really want to see what people think of the Reversing Roe documentary, which can be found on Netflix. If you're a Netflix subscriber, it's there. It's in a great collection of documentaries that they have available, which I'll definitely be reviewing more and more of the documentaries from Netflix, including ones like Ava DuVernay's 13th. That'll be coming at a later date. But definitely would love to hear what you have to say. If you have been watching this on YouTube, or even if you've been listening on the radio, feel free to stop by the YouTube channel, drop a like, subscribe to the channel. It helps with the algorithm tremendously. If you're listening on radio, as I said, thank you for listening. We're going to get to our final thought in just a second, but just to wrap things up, Reversing Roe is an excellently produced documentary, really broadcasting and showcasing an issue that's been at the heart of society and culture, and for the reason that people wanted it to be at the heart of society and culture for quite some time now. I was, of course, born into it. Many people in my generational cohort were born into the discussion, but it really does an excellent job of framing the mindsets from both sides of the argument and equation, and really showing the dogged determination, especially from the pro-life side of things, of how hard they wanted to work to flip the Supreme Court and get enough justices to overturn Roe v. Wade. And it's culminated in an actual reality in that Roe v. Wade has been passed. Now, one of my larger personal opinions, and this is just something that I'm sharing, is that The blame for this also partially falls squarely on the shoulders of Congress and every president since 1973, so that would mean Gerald Ford, all the way on down, that had an option to codify the passage of Roe v. Wade into federal law and instead left it up to the decision of the court, slowly stripped away the powers of Roe v. Wade over time, and that leaded and culminated in this past Friday's decision to essentially overturn it altogether. Now, elected officials do have a chance to codify abortion access and women's reproductive health care access into law. And however you feel about it, the whole point of, you know, pro-life or pro-choice versus anti-choice is that people have the choice. We don't get to legislate what other people do with their bodies. And so no matter how morally superior you may feel about an issue, at the end of the day, there is no right that we have to impose our will on other people's body unless they're imposing their will on someone else's body, at which point we have people bring up the moral argument that is pseudoscientific, that a fetus is a person, which I personally don't agree with. There's no way that you can prove that because we don't have not only a full standard for personhood, but the truth of the matter is anything can happen between when conception takes place and a baby is finally born into the world. So that's something that everyone can go back and forth on. What is undoubtable is that Roe v. Wade, or that Reversing Roe, the documentary, is an excellent production by Netflix that I would highly recommend for anyone that's looking to be both entertained and informed at the same time. We're going to move on, though, to our final thought of the day. And that thought is to always, always move with at least some concern for your neighbor. Unless what they're doing represents a detriment to you, so often we see laws get passed and things get done. And I think this is especially poignant and necessary now with the overturn of Roe v. Wade, to know and understand that even if you're not a woman, this is partially your fight, because equality is everyone's fight. You know, so we see men in Congress pass these laws, these oppressive laws, all the time, and it's a snowball, man. Justice Thomas pointed it out in his opinion, his concurring opinion, which is that they're going to be looking at marriage equality next, same-sex relationships even being allowed. There's all these things that they're looking to overturn and repeal that have not been fully codified into federal law and guaranteed constitutionally to everyone in this country. And we have to learn that intersectionality is a real thing. Just because you are not an immediate part or immediate member of an oppressed group of people does not mean that you are A, not oppressed, or that you won't be further oppressed in the future. We always remove and extricate ourselves from some fights that don't involve us because we feel as though, well, they don't directly affect us. But what we allow to happen to our neighbors can and usually does one day happen to us. It's the same reason why the Holocaust happened in Germany. It's why slavery was allowed to persist for so long, because if we turned a blind eye to the suffering of others, who will we turn to when that same suffering is inflicted upon us? So please, move with love for your neighbors and understand that fights against injustice are all of our fights to fight. Go through this week. Love your neighbor as yourself. That golden rule is one of the most important ones in all of the universe. Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Take care of yourselves, and as always, God bless.
Looking in the mirror, I know I'm imperfect. Just like everybody else I know. Most times I wish the world looked beneath the surface. But I guess that's how life goes. Had to learn to love myself this time around. Pop a bottle in and take a sip just because. Book a flight and then take a trip just because. Love myself just because.